valuation is some kind of like mental construct. So I think it just makes sense to decouple the treasury income from this mechanism. It's more easy from the incentive perspective when you burn it, because then it's a clear cost.
It's a little bit wonkier.
Good luck and Godspeed.
Space Monkeys, blasting off with Jonas Gerlein. He's a research scientist at the Web3 Foundation. Probably seen him on Twitter. Jonas, very happy to have him here at this beautiful food hall. Jonas, welcome to the show. Nice
Thanks
to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
Excellent.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Could you clarify for us exactly what a research scientist for the Web3 Foundation does?
I'm an economist by training. Right? I'm trying to do papers. I'm trying to publish papers on a very academic level. Hmm. But I also like to go into applied research, like really have a tangible problem and trying to solve that with the tools that are given by academia. But there's always this balance between like going for a full paper that, you know, in academia can take several years and then also taking some like applied approach where you can basically fix a problem very, very quickly.
What's the purpose of papers? I mean, is it here's my understanding.
Okay.
Papers is to show off to other people who do papers, but there's probably a deeper meaning.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, okay.
But I mean, the original idea, of course, is to inform other researchers about the current state of research, about how you solve the problem.
Right.
And ideally, people that want to solve a problem look into academic research. Maybe there's already a solution there, right?
Right.
So they don't have to go the same route, the same, do the same research again.
So you spend a lot of time reading papers as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
It's part of whenever you want to like make a new paper, make a new research study, you first start out and see what is already done on the topic.
Sure.
And the nice thing about blockchain research is that it's quite young. And there's a lot of potential to solve problems there, yeah.
Yeah, do you see a lot of papers coming out of the universities or coming out of other blockchain organizations?
Yeah, I think both.
Both.
I think very interestingly in the last years, academic, like research from the academic institutes really took off in a way. Hmm. I mean, of course, like the traditional fields are way overrepresented, but the research is growing also. More and more journals. This is where you basically send the papers, and then like there's some peers that evaluate what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the really good journals are open for blockchain topics.
Is there a blockchain journal yet, or are
I mean,
we,
there are there, there are, are countless yeah. journals, right? Everybody can do their own journal. That's also a little bit the risk, but they have a reputation, right? You can really see the good journals. They are known, and if you want to publish the paper and have it seen well, I would say you, as an economist, at least you want to go into the traditional, more the traditional route.
Okay, all right. So it's a whole system of reputation and publishing.
Yeah, I think reputation is a driving factor in academic research.
So one paper you've been working on recently, this is exciting for us because the Kusumarian has launched, we've launched a validator ourselves.
Oh, okay,
well,
that's
with
great.
Some help, with some
okay,
help.
Okay,
but so, we're getting into the game here.
Yeah,
what have you been working on?
So, yeah, one paper that I recently published with some of my co-authors is exactly about validator selection.
Mm.
That is published in a very nice journal, also quite traditional journal. We developed an algorithm that helps to elicit preferences from the nominators to make a suitable recommendation of validators.
I saw a little widget on your Twitter, like maybe 5 months ago or something.
Yeah, that is exactly that, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So what we did is basically you have a little bit of a problem when you want to recommend validators, right? Because you could do the very naive way of saying like, well, you know, the Web3 Foundation finds these validators very cool. Just pick them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there we have obviously like a big conflict of interest and like it's not such a nice like setup, right? Like, and also it would be kind of the same recommendation for everybody, which is also not ideal, right?
That's right.
So what we did in this study is basically we created some model of how you can, ask several questions to a specific nominator and take the answers and learn about their preferences. So what do they like, right? Mm. What are they interested in? And after a few of these questions, we learn basically enough to make a tailored recommendation to you or like to any other nominator.
What are the questions like?
The questions are quite easy. We just show you two different validators and we show all the statistics on them, right? Like the error points, the self-stake, whether they have identity or not, and so on, and how many others are voting for those validators. And then we just ask you which do you like more.
Okay.
And then you say, I like this one more, I like this one more, I like this one more. And after like a couple of these questions, we can basically create a model in the background that tells us, that basically gives a utility value, like how good is every validator in the set.
Yeah.
And we can then simply rank them by the highest utility to the lowest.
Wow.
And we can basically take the top 16 and say, based on your answers, like these 16 validators suit you the best.
That is so cool.
Yeah. It's all deployed open source. It uses the Light client, so it's also very reliable in a way that you don't need to have like an RPC node always on or something.
Yeah. Was this inspired by Tinder?
No. Well, maybe. I mean, it wasn't really inspired at first, but then you thought like, oh, well, it's not... nothing different than like just swiping.
That's right, right, yeah. But, it's a model that works.
Yeah, right. Maybe if somebody's interested, they can put like the Tinder UI on top of it and you just swipe your validators.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Also, right now, I'm looking a lot more into the auctions. That is a research project that started quite a while ago.
Yeah.
From a an auction theory perspective, how good are the candle auctions?
Mm.
The candle auction mechanism itself, because it was basically invented in real life, right? It's like from the 14th century or something, where there were auctions with literal candles and they were bidding until the candle went out, but it never really took off. Hmm. Of course, I think there's still like one candle auction per year in some pub in England or something,
and okay.
They are basically selling, I don't know, some small items, I guess.
Mm.
But it was never applied to a scale that actually Polkadot and Kusama did, right?
That's cool.
If you think about it, like the amount of tokens that have been locked with this mechanism is like without comparison, right? It's a lot, right?
Totally.
So it's always interesting to see how well they performed, even though that with the new core time model they might be deprecated in the short term.
Yeah.
But I think it's still very valuable to look at them, and also I think it's valuable to look at them in different perspectives. The first one would be like just to look at the mechanism itself.
Mm.
Does the mechanism lead to the results that you want?
Hmm.
But then also, was it useful to actually, lease off 2 years periods or something? Worked quite well. So in auction theory, we have this notion of efficiency.
Okay.
Which basically means that you want to give the good, whatever you are selling, to the bidder with the highest valuation.
Hmm.
And valuation is some kind of like mental construct of how much would you be willing to pay for that, right?
Okay.
That is very hard to grasp because you cannot obviously look into the heads of people, right? You don't know how much people would be willing to buy or to bid. And for that reason, we created like a laboratory experiment where we were actually in control about how we actually knew how much each of the bidders were willing to bid, or actually their valuation, and then we could look at different mechanisms of how, you know, like the candle auction we compared to the hard close rule, like this simple eBay, like after some certain time we just end the auction.
Yeah.
And then the activity rule, where you basically whenever there's a new bid coming in towards the end, we just extend the end.
Yeah, right.
And we could basically compare these different mechanisms with each other. And in the laboratory, we found that the candle auction works quite well in the efficiency factor, right? Those bidders that had the highest valuation, and we knew that because we gave them these valuations, they, in 90% of the cases, also got the good.
Wow.
And then when you look at it on an empirical state, like when you just look at the auctions that happened on Kusama and Polkadot, it's a little bit more complicated because, as I said, you cannot look into the heads of the bidders. You don't know how much they would be willing to bid for the good. But what you can do as a light, you know, simplification is to just look at the highest bid at the end of the auction, and then you kind of see whether this bidder actually got the good.
Ah, okay.
I mean the slot, right? The 2-year slot. And it also turns out that like in more than, I think, 80-85% of the cases, that was actually the case, right?
Right.
So what is kind of cool is to see that the candle mechanism itself also works, even though it's a novel application in blockchain, right?
Sure.
It's exotic in a way. But, you know, there were different reasons why this was chosen. I don't need to go into the details, but but the blockchain space actually make this candle auction work very nicely. And now we basically have the proof that in the lab and also in the field, like the real auctions, they turned out to be quite nice.
There's an element of randomness in it as well. How did that affect outcomes?
So, I mean, what happens is that once this candle period starts, basically on-chain, I think we take samples to reduce the size. I think every 20 blocks, the auction can actually finish in a way, even though it continues, right? This retrospective ending block.
Mm.
And the probability is uniformly distributed. So every of these samples has the same probability to basically end it, right?
Is this part of the state, like it's known that it ends at this block, or is that decided after the candle goes out?
No, it's after. Yeah.
It's after,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah, okay, that's the whole point, right? So you wanted to have some incentive for the bidders to reveal their valuations very early on.
Yeah.
Because there's always the risk, if you wait too long, for example, sniping, right?
Yeah.
What happens on these eBay things is that you basically wait until the last second to snipe in your bid.
Yeah.
And that is something that, you know, is not really good. It's not very efficient. So the candle mechanism explicitly tries to solve that by actually basically making clear that if you wait too long, it could already be over, right? So you want to be, if you really want to have the good, you should bid early.
Would you change any of the parameters of the candle auction to make it more efficient in retrospect?
It's working fine like it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It goes maybe a little bit more into the direction whether we should change the whole mechanism itself, right? Mm-hmm. We basically deprecate this auction mechanism in total. And I think it's a very good idea now, but I think it's also important to think about why we had it in the first place. Because, you know, like leasing off these 2 years of slots really made sense in the beginning, right? Because you were enabling teams to really create a good community. They needed to have like some more certainty because they had to make like big upfront investments in time and effort to actually get their code going and so on, right? So I think that was very valuable. And also the crowd loan system obviously was very good because whom do you give the tokens to at the beginning of your project, right? You want to give them to people that are actually interested in your use case. They should stay around. They should be interested in the project that you do, right? And I think crowd loans are like the perfect way to do that.
Yes.
Because you elicit some interest of the people that actually, you know, contribute to your project. And you are able to actually efficiently allocate the tokens, right? You give them to the people that probably are very interested in your project.
Right, there's like this conviction level to locking your tokens.
Lock up your tokens and you basically pay the opportunity cost of like foregoing in staking and liquidity. So I think that is kind of nice and that worked very well. But I think also now is the perfect time to go a little bit away from this system, these like 2-year leases. Many of these projects were still building very crucial infrastructure, right? They are building infrastructure on top of Polkadot's infrastructure, which you really require for additional use cases, right? But I think we are now at the point where you want to make these core time allocations more agile and like bring in more people that just want to mess around with the code, right? I mean, this is also what Gav said, and I think it comes to the perfect time. That you don't want to like first you have to win some auction, then you get a 2 years lease, and then you maybe, you know, you deploy your stuff. You want to get now the people in that just try to fill the block space with interesting stuff, right?
No doubt.
So yeah, I think in general this is what I want to say. Like the auctions, they worked. The auction mechanism worked quite nicely. It was also good that we had this period. I think it was very good for the like kickstart of the project, like the network.
Yeah.
And now it's the perfect time to kind of change that and go into a more agile area.
I had an interesting comment from Ingo Ruba, was on the show recently, mm-hmm. Kilt Protocol, and he pointed out that, well, there's been this sort of flip of incentives for parachains. He was speaking to how when a project locks their own dots, they're sort of incentivized to make the Polkadot network thrive as much as possible, mm-hmm. because the value of their initial investment can grow, and when they get it unlocked, they have all this thing. Now, perhaps they want Polkadot to be as cheap as possible because there's this cost that they're never getting back.
Yeah,
what do you think about that idea?
I think it's definitely true when you consider that these projects are self-funded in a way.
Yeah, right.
It is not entirely true, I would say, for what we saw in the beginning, because most of the funds, I would say, came actually from the community, right?
Yeah.
Most of the big, you know, projects were funded by crowd loans.
Mm-hmm.
And there I don't see how, you know, I as a project have an incentive. You know, I'm not locking my own tokens, let's say, right? But it's a good point that crowd loans were always kind of designed to be the on-ramp for the first kind of parachain slot. And after that, projects should find some self-sustaining way to keep funding their slots. And in that way, I think it's a very valid concern that once you have most of the project self-funding, they actually would like to lock less. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, interesting point. Thank you. Let's keep digging into the economics here. The treasury.
Yeah.
You just made a major change.
What you're talking about is referendum 166.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So tell us about that. That was received some pushback from the community, probably all major changes will.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also good. I mean, there's good discussions around. So originally there was this plan of this rough estimate of like 60% maybe locked in staking, 65 or 40%, no, 40%, 30% in liquidity and 30% in these crowd loans, or not in the slot auctions, right?
Yeah.
And with the slot auctions being deprecated, it doesn't make any sense to assume that there's like 30% being locked anymore, right? And even after like the initial big crowd loan phases, like I think especially the first two sets of auctions, the first two lease periods, we saw like a steady decline on the lockup of the tokens. So this didn't make much sense to keep this keep the ideal staking rate this low, right?
Right, and it was also tied to the amount of parachains we had as
exactly,
well, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it was scaling down 0.5% with every active parachain, non-system parachains,
mm-hmm.
Until we reached a minimum of 45%, and 45% is sufficient for decent enough economic security. But my argument was that, you know, basically these big unlocks, they don't see a counter, like they don't, you know, see any further demand of locking tokens.
Yeah.
Right? So it didn't make sense to basically leave this old system in. And a short-term fix for this was basically to change the formula of how the ideal staking rate is being calculated, to just push it up to roughly 6%, 60% right now.
Mm.
And, you know, in the short to medium term, we might, you know, with no like parachain slots or para IDs being around, it might make sense to further adjust the system.
Sure. Up to governance now every time?
Everything is up to governance.
Right.
Nothing can pass without interaction with the community, which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty cool. So that's also the path that I'm personally want to take in the near future, is that we want to expose the parameters of the inflation system, or like the, you know, these parameters to governance, so that people basically can make a referendum of what the new ideal staking rate should be.
Yeah.
Or what the new inflation should be. Or,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes there's feelings that the incredible rewards from inflation for staking and whatnot maybe makes people less incentivized to participate in the DeFi ecosystem and things like that.
Do you
give thought to that?
Yeah, that was a big voice also in this referendum 166,
yeah.
which I thought was a little bit misplaced.
Hmm.
Some people argued that it's actually good that that we might overshoot the ideal staking rate, which means that we exponentially give more rewards to the treasury because it would decrease the staking API,
mm-hmm.
which is good for DeFi. Right,
right. Right.
But I thought that is a little bit short-sighted. And if you have this opinion, what you should really be working on is like the inflation, right, to reduce the inflation.
Mm.
And I can see the point that that DeFi. So the basic problem is that you have some yield on the relay chain from staking, right? Let's say, I don't know, 15%. And for like DeFi protocols, for DeFi kind of utilities to make sense, you need to give more than 15% because otherwise people would be just staking their dots on the relay chain, right? And I'm actually looking forward to the discussions about that. So once we expose these parameters, I'm sure there will be a big discussion about it.
Cool.
I think it's also important to understand that the staking API is a big part of the economic security of the network.
It's true.
Right? Because validators and nominators need incentive to work. And especially validators, the earnings of a validator is directly correlated or even caused the security of the validator, right?
Like, that's right.
A validator that earns more has less incentive to screw up, basically, right?
Mm.
If you talk about this DeFi problem, I think the value doesn't matter that much. It's more about the yield, and it's, you know, whatever, like, it's relative, right? If you shift the value, it's like the problem shifts on both sides, up and down. So I think it's more a discussion on the API itself, on it, basically on the inflation.
Got it. So right now we're at a steady 10%.
Yeah.
And
roughly, yeah.
Yeah, roughly 10%. And we have the situation where if we're plus or minus the ideal staking, we cut a little bit of rewards to nominators, stakers,
and
we
and
give
validators.
It to the treasury and validators, and we give it to the treasury.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, there's been some discussion since around Decoded of maybe taking a slice of that inflation and permanently feeding it into the treasuries.
Yeah.
What have you been working on in this area?
I think the main communication happened in the Polkadot forum here. I posted, that was a little bit before the time of RFCs.
Yeah.
And there's already a bunch of discussion there, so I think it makes sense to just leave it there.
Hmm.
And my general idea was that, again, this like it makes sense to revisit this mechanism. Because it is kind of counterintuitive that you say you have something that is ideal, that you want the network to be converging to.
Yeah.
But once it's there, Treasury gets zero income and maybe a little bit from transaction fees, which is basically negligible. Like it doesn't contribute much. And it worked for now, right? I mean, the Treasury is well funded.
Mm.
But I think we can do better than that. And also, I think Treasury management becomes much more important now. We see so many discussions in OpenGov,
mm-hmm.
and both on the proposer side and also on those that decide a little bit, you know, do a little bit of budgeting, like how you vote, basically. You want to have more certainty, right? You don't want that you don't know the income in 1 year of the treasury because maybe the ideal staking rate is identical and then you don't get any income.
Yeah, right.
So I think it just makes sense to decouple the treasury income from this mechanism. And this doesn't increase the inflation. The inflation would be fixed at 10%, whatever the people then choose to. But historically, I checked the data and it was around 20% that was going into treasury because of the staking inefficiency.
Mm.
So it's a natural point to just put it at 20% for now.
Do you imagine doing away with the ideal staking rate in this situation, or would you still have
Yeah, it's a good question. I think this is also open to discussion. I think there's a value to, like, this ideal staking rate is kind of an interesting concept because it makes sense to keep the network in some balance with respect to the staking rate, right? And this mechanism of incentivizing to push towards that also makes sense. The question is, what is the perfect value? It's a good question, and I guess this is also open for discussion once this parameter is basically exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it makes sense to have an ideal staking rate.
But if we give it that 2%, let's say, haircut, that's going to affect rewards to validators and nominators, won't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does. It does a bit. But my argument is that if you compare the API of Polkadot to some of the other projects, it's quite high. It makes also kind of sense because the lockup period, like the bonding unbonding period of 28 days, is also very long.
Yeah.
So you need to compensate stakers for the illiquidity there. But it also ties nicely into the discussion that we had before, right? That we have some room maybe to cut the API.
Right.
Because it would allow more easy competition of DeFi projects and so on, right?
That's right, right.
The API would go down, but I think we have enough room to let it happen. Right? Especially when we fund the treasury, it would obviously make sense.
Kind of imagining, you know, there's so much scrutiny on treasury spending today.
Yeah.
So just wait until people's rewards get chopped a little bit and they find out, oh, it's going to treasury.
Yeah, yeah.
So scrutiny is a good thing, of course. But
yeah.
Yeah.
This and also when I was proposing 166, people were like coming all out and saying like, oh, the API is way too high. It's way too high. But I want to see the discussion when somebody's proposing, let's cut the API by 6% or something, right?
Then it's like,
then you
right.
see really also the other people coming up.
True say,
that's also the interesting part, right? Like, there's always people that disagree.
Yeah.
And I think it's very good. It's very valuable to have these discussions.
One disagreement happening now, and honestly, it could go either way, is this burning of the core time fees.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think it makes sense. That's also why I did the RFC on it, right?
Yeah.
I did two RFCs. One RFC is about burning the core time revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So once we moved to this agile core time, where basically core time is allocated every 2 weeks through some mechanism, the question is, what do you do with the revenue? And my take on this is that diverting to treasury. So you could also turn it around. Why should it go to treasury, right?
Yeah.
Because I expect it to be rather low in the beginning and in the midterm, right?
Sure,
because we already see that core time is underutilized.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, attracts new people, but it's just a fact.
Yeah.
And so the treasury doesn't really, it cannot live from it, let's say, right? So we need some mechanism still to get the funds into the treasury. And this is what I propose with the forum post, with basically, you know, minting a fixed amount of the inflation to treasury. So once you fix that, once treasury just has the funds, why do you need to divert more to it?
Okay, yeah.
And it's more easy from the incentive perspective when you burn it, because then it's a clear cost, right?
Yeah.
Just imagine somebody buys core time. It gets burned. It's a clear cost.
Sure.
But if it's diverted to treasury, and maybe that entity, you know, also has a lot of, you know, gets a lot of funding from treasury, then like the incentives are a little bit weird, right? Maybe that entity just like pays 70% of the core time because it basically gets reimbursed from the treasury a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
Or they increase the costs for some other project and then they you know, get something back.
It's a little bit wonkier.
It's a little bit wonkier, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think just burning makes it very, very easy.
Nice.
It's also, since we have 10% inflation, I don't think inflation is inherently bad, especially for a utility token. I think it's okay, especially, I think what's more important is predictability, at least, especially on the upper bound, right? But, you know, even then when we see core time to be quite valuable, it's also a nice mechanism to reduce inflation, right?
Sure, yeah.
Not to set it by some parameter, but actually to let the network decide by its own.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, but as you said, for now in the short midterm, it's not really going to affect the economics that much. It'll be a very small burn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so maybe some meme worthiness, but other than that, nothing.
Yeah, I mean, that's also one part of it, right? I wouldn't say it's the most important part, but it also changes the narrative, right?
It does, yeah. Very good. Did you do any research for governance, OpenGov, anything like that?
A little bit. So nothing that I have something concrete on yet.
Okay.
But I thought about this very interesting mechanism of basically having a moving approval rating thing, right? I think, you know, we decrease the quorum rules. As you know, in OpenGov, you have like these two curves, right?
Yeah.
You need support and approval. And I think that is quite unique. I never saw that in academic papers or something.
Cool.
And it might be interesting to take a closer look there and see whether this can actually lead to a situation where you get good decisions, but much faster.
Okay. I saw Rob suggested an idea where the spend proposed could also adjust based on the amount of support it's getting.
Ah, right. Okay.
Think about that.
Yeah, that's also interesting. Yeah. I think there's the devil is probably in the detail, right? There's like, you need to look at this from the incentive perspective. So when do you vote and how do you vote and who's voting?
Hmm.
I think it's right now it's pretty clear people, you know, also, for example, if you're a project and you're proposing to do something for some value X, maybe you cannot do it for less. Right?
That's right.
But what
right.
happens if you get 80% of it? Like,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not an unfixable problem, but you need to think about that.
Interesting. Who directs your research?
So I have a boss, of course.
You have a boss?
Alistair Stewart. He's a great, great researcher.
Okay.
Yeah. He knows so many things, and he's one of the key researchers way before my time, like from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm in constant contact with him,
right.
of course. But aside from that, I'm a little bit my own researcher.
Okay.
I try to find my own projects. I try to, keep it important. But it's not that, you know, there are like three economists and we have some idea and then we say, you do this project, I do this project.
Right.
It's,
Okay.
I'm a little bit my own boss.
Do you find inspiration in any other architectures or ecosystems outside of Polkadot?
Yeah, I think in general, like also this burning thing, I think it was discussed in other ecosystems.
Of course,
and it was,
yeah.
There's some research about that you should burn the fees, from an incentive perspective. But aside from this, I think what we do is quite unique.
Very nice. So where are we going? Let's say 6 months to 18 months. Where should the researchers watching this show, where should they put their minds?
Okay, so, I mean, obviously, agile core time is a big thing.
Yeah.
I think I also published an RFC on deficient, making these markets a little bit more efficient. But
right.
That was quite early on. I think it's still valuable. I don't know, the state of it, like I think the fellowship needs to vote on these proposals at some point. But then I also saw these projects popping up that create their own markets, right? Which is amazing to see.
We just had Phil on the show.
Yeah,
actually.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is pretty cool.
Very cool.
And then that's where we're going, and that's the big thing, right?
Again, for any researchers that could be watching, how could they get more involved in the ecosystem? Do you think there's a place for like independent researching agents in the ecosystem?
I think generally, yes. I think especially research is a little bit tricky because if you really want to go the traditional route, like you want to publish the papers, which gives some credibility, of course, for your research, it's a very long and tedious process.
Yeah.
Right? Until you get this paper finally published, can take up to 5 years, even longer. So it's not an obvious, let's say, it's not an obvious way to do like a research agency. And then, you know, they keep asking the Treasury for funds for 5 years and like you know.
Yeah, good
it's,
luck.
It's very hard.
Good luck.
But still, I think it's always good to reach out. I mean, I'm always open if somebody's interested. I'm always collaborating with researchers outside of the ecosystem, right, with traditional researchers to make this intersection between blockchain and traditional research. So, yeah.
So sweet.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming to the show.
Thank
we covered
you.
A lot of ground
yeah.
there. So that is super cool.
Yeah,
we
thanks.
Will see you in the forums on RFCs.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just thanks very much for all the work you do.
You're welcome. And thank you for interviewing me.